Hello everyone, my guest today is Tarik Jauhan. He was recognized by Forbes as one of the top 50 executives in the UAE, or one of the top 50 CEOs in the UAE. He actually started out in India, born and raised there, built up a company, and then around 1999 lost everything, didn't have any money, then started again, built up another company, financial technologies is company, acquired a banking license, and in the finance crisis 2008 again lost basically everything, didn't have any money anymore, and then got a job as a CEO of a company called EFS Facilities, a facility management company. At that time the company was doing around 20 million euros in revenue. Now, 10 years later, he built up the company to over 400 million in revenue. It's a $1 billion company in terms of valuation. 18,000 employees are under his management, basically. And what's really interesting is that the company has a 97% client retention rate and a 92% employee satisfaction. So these are like some really great numbers where I think a lot of companies can learn something from. So listen to the interview. I'm looking forward to getting your feedback on it. And yeah, let's dive into it. Tarik, yeah. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thanking you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So you're in Dubai right now, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Dubai at the moment.
Nice. Okay, we met last year actually in person in Dubai, and what I realized down the road is that Forbes revealed you as one of the top 50 Indian executives in the UAE. What do you think about that, and would you say that's accurate? And if yes, why?
Well, usually these sort of listings are based on multiple criteria. And when I was informed back in 5 years back, I was listed and I was featured on the front page of Forbes magazine in the Middle East. Indeed, it was a great honor for me. That helped me. There were two ways I could look at that. I could have either kept it in my resume and would have flaunted that picture everywhere. Or second thing, I took that as a responsibility on me, and I started building from there onwards on my thought leadership. So it was indeed when a first Forbes realized and when they featured me, that helped me to build on from there. So in the last year, when I was informed that I am amongst the top five executives in the Middle East listed by Forbes, once again, it brought on me additional responsibilities, how I could be better. And I thought these sort of honors or these sort of recognitions puts the leadership into a much more microscopic review of people. And I have to build on from there. So between last year and this year, I did work on not only about the my role as a CEO of EFS Group, but also as a business leader, where I could build positive messaging to businesses currently struggling, as well to help young executives and C-suite members to learn from how to navigate through difficult circumstances. So yeah, all this was out of my own introspection of what I'm supposed to take from these listings. So that has indeed helped me and indeed helped the community at large to get some sort of transformative input from my end.
Got it. So you see it as a positive thing to even get better from. Now you're the CEO of a big company. You have like thousands of employees in Dubai and are operating in like 20 plus plus countries with EFS, and you can elaborate on that a bit, what EFS actually does. But how did you get there? What was your way to becoming one of the top CEOs in the UAE?
See, it was not about my own position as becoming a top CEO. For me, it was about my company and my organization. I have always believed that to build a large enterprise, what are you trying to accomplish from a large enterprise? Where you're able to create employment opportunities, where you're able to deliver world-class solutions to your client, you're able to create substantial share value for your shareholders, and able to provide a long, sustainable career progression and development for your employees. What I have accomplished in this journey is a true sustainable, 360 degree benefits to all the stakeholders. And that's what I'm very proud of. EFS operates in more than 21 countries. It employs over 18,000 people. 2/3 of EFS workforce still continues to be blue-collar workforce. Retaining 97% client, having a 97% client retention, over 85% in performance scorecards, with the last 10 years track record of employee satisfaction surveys standing above 92% to 94%. With the highest ever employee retention, I'm privileged, and I feel that any good organization, what it should identify itself is with some sustainable benchmarks, and that's what we have accomplished. So it's not about the strength of the employee workforce, or it is not about the size of the company. It's just not about its bottom line. It's about the what impact it has created. And I think I'm very proud to say that from every benchmark that one would look from a sustainable enterprise perspective, EFS has scored on every aspect.
Yeah. I mean, if I look at the numbers, like 97% client retention, 92% employee satisfaction across 18,000 employees. I think these are numbers other companies can dream of. So that's really good. How did you get there? What was your journey to becoming the CEO of EFS, and what stations and things did you do before?
One was something about learning from mistakes, applying learning from when I did things, and based on outcome of each step, I realized that you need a continuous introspection to improvise on what you have accomplished and what you have missed on. Build a team of outstanding professionals. Now, to build a team and developing a trust of such an impeccable nature required, one has to walk the talk. And I realized that no benchmark can be accomplished unless I realign my own personal elements, both in terms of trust, being a trusted leader, also being a competent CEO, also being a good human. Because to build a bond with such a large and diverse set of people, both in terms of economically, there are people from blue collar workforce that earn less than $1,000 a month, to people those who are earning $25,000 a month. So when you have such a diverse set of people working with so many different nationalities, so many different ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, working in three different subcontinents. What was common to all that was the trust. And trust to build a people's organization required many aspects. Responsible leadership, compassionate communication, deep diving, walking the talk on most aspects, being on top of your agenda as well, creating a delegation across your C-suite, helping people to show that self-development is ultimately reflects on the larger good of the organization. So if I was focusing on individual good, I was trying to tell them that this individual good will ultimately drive the larger organizational good. This sort of bonding and trust was always on my mind, and I worked very diligently over the years. And I'm proud to say that today, 95% of my employees strongly believes that CEO walks the talk. As I have built an organization where everybody has the via media and a medium to speak out, and we are able to communicate and engage them. That doesn't mean that we don't work on appeasement when it comes to engaging with employees. We work on transparent communication, compassionate communication, and sharing between pains and gains, you know. So they come forward with when we need them to be the part of the pains that we go through. Either it could be a difficult market that we have to navigate, or it could be sometimes very, very tough operational challenges, difficult client engagements, certain very challenging and demanding contracts. And across all such exposures, what I've seen, it is the people's organization and our core values that has helped us to ride through this through those moments.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is a great thing, and I will think we will focus on that a little bit later in the podcast. But Tarek, what I'm interested in is your personal story. So how did you grow up, and what brought you to Dubai, actually?
Okay. I'm 54, turning 55. I started my life back in a small town in India, which is primarily a city of in India. It was a small town, but it was primarily an education city where there was a couple of education institutions. Born in a family of seven siblings, purely in a middle class environment. My dad and my mom had to fed for seven of us. My dad used to work as a technical officer.
How would you describe middle class? Because I think this is a very interesting point where not a lot of people have an understanding
My father could just meet up to pay for our education and for our basic living. So it wasn't something that we were living in. We would live in a three-bedroom house with seven siblings. So we just lived a reasonable. We never had to fend for anything. The food and education and clothes, everything was provided without much of a difficulty, but it wasn't something that we had. We were never had the privilege of being rich when we were growing up.
Yeah, got it. Understood.
That's right. Yeah. So then I did my graduation in economics. I went into doing my master's in macroeconomics. Whilst I was finishing my master's, an opportunity came from an American company to work for one of their products, which primarily was in waterproofing. Although my background was primarily economics and history and political science. And then I landed up selling as a salesman for an engineering product. I've worked with that organization for about 6 months, but being middle class, there was a tremendous pressure from dad to look for a white collar kind of a job with that gives you a secure job and a good social standing. So I landed up getting a job in a bank. So when I was 21,
in India or in the US?
It was in India. And this was a job in Bombay where I worked for a global, an international bank, which was primarily a Middle Eastern bank with their office in India. So I started as a trainee officer. And from trainee officer, I, within 3 years, moved through multiple progressions to becoming a, when I was in 1990, I became a treasurer of the bank. And I was managing currencies and money markets portfolio. I did extraordinarily well as a young kid in that in those roles. Was loved by many, but also envied by so many because I was too ambitious for that age and that role. Found whilst I was working, met my wife then, who I married in just in 6 months. And then I'm a Muslim and my wife is a Catholic Christian. So it was a quite a difficult journey because of two different religions. It's not that easy back home in India to marry somebody who of your choice, but we just loved each other and we've been married for 30 years. And then I moved on to work for another bank called Indosuez, where I moved on to a much more challenging role as a head of risk management. I worked for Indosuez for a period of 1.5 years. And then our daughter was born, the first daughter, which is now 28. And then I realized that being a family man, I need to take my next plunge. So I landed up with a job in Saudi Arabia with an organization that used to be the agent for AT&T. And I joined there as a corporate treasurer and worked for about close to almost 2 years in Saudi Arabia. Again, did extraordinarily well in what I was doing in that particular role. Primarily those days, I used to be managing about plus $100 million overnight limits in currency trades. So Deutsche Mark used to be my favorite currency. And I went on to take a very long position of about $75 million long on Deutsche Mark against dollar. And we happened to be there. Interestingly, my organization I used to work for used to be the agent for Nivea. So they would go and, you know, buy a lot of Nivea. They were the agents of Nivea. So they would go and buy Nivea products. So I took that position, realized that I was definitely not doing well with that particular holding on that position. But fortunately, because I had my merchant requirements, so I somehow exited from that particular position. From that day onwards, I decided that I would never speculate or go that long in my professional position. And I decided then to pursue a more somber career in banking with concentrating on wealth management and distribution of third party, you know, what we call it is white labeling of some of the banking products. So I came to Dubai back then in 1995, established a financial services company with a license from Central Bank of UAE. And then once again, got onto another ambitious trip of building an institution in financial services. where I landed up representing some of the largest tuitions in the world as a
part
of
that. This was now your own company, right? Like you were the founder.
I was the founder, but I was I originally founded the company, but I was not the owner. It was owned by a large financial services chain. But just in about a year and a half time, I realized that I did see extraordinary success in what I was doing. And being ambitious, I went on to do a leverage buyout of my owners, of the ownership from the previous owners. And I became the owner of the company. That journey was interesting, outstanding growth. However, it did bring on me definitive financial obligations and certain misjudgments. So I went on to acquire the company, but I could not sustain it. And
what do you mean by you couldn't sustain it?
A reason why, because I went on to build a organization that had a huge running cost, and the revenue side was very impressive, but collections were not coming through. So just in a year and a half time after my leverage buyout, I landed up with financial challenges, couldn't sustain the size of the business that I was running. Then I did a retreat a little bit by selling off my stake to a alternative investor, and then went on to join a partner with NHF, another financial services company. But the learning from the previous failure was that this time I did not go into my own capital commitment. I went into my expertise and my credibility, and the my partners brought the capital and the infrastructure platform. So with them, then I built on for 5 years, one of the most successful transaction services business that we later sold to a large Emirates entity, and then moved to build a payment platform with two large global institutions with a patronage from them. Because the business that I built over the previous 5 years was a transaction services and home remittances platform. So that gave me a global credibility. I was able to build on one of the finest relationship. I spent a lot of time in Frankfurt and London and New York and London those days, because I was working with one of the finest banks in the world. And then went on with that knowledge and experience to build a payment platform and technology out of Dubai Internet City. Whilst I built my technology platform business, I also went on to create two other verticals within the business of technology, in supply chain and in e-business integration. That led me to build one of the most successful IT businesses of my during those days. And then simultaneously, I also went on to take my technology business into fintech business and went and acquired a bank in banking license in Malta, Financial Service Authority. So
you got a banking license.
Yeah, banking license. Where I was I was the main founder as well as the co-investor. So I went on to acquire that banking license in Malta.
How much does it cost to acquire a banking license?
See, that capitalization, because it was a trade and investment bank, Malta Financial Services Authority is allowed 5 million euros as a capital at that time. And I was one of the... So I leveraged my house and I did the equity finance on my house to finance my part of the capital.
Nice.
So one thing common has been in my business that I have always been very ambitious. However, all my risk, I took risk to the extent that I could hold on or I could retreat. It was never a doomsday in any of those risks, even when I retreated. So in 2007, unfortunately, due to the financial crisis and with the failure of the Lehman and others, I again landed up with another crisis where my partners decided not to pursue the banking, not to pursue their part of capitalization. And my technology business also came under a tremendous pressure due to my commitment for my banking business, because I was putting investment in my banking business in order to build a long-term initiative in the banking industry. So this was my second debacle. And my first debacle was back in 1998. The second debacle happened in the 2008. And I won't say bankruptcy, but I was absolutely, I had zero cash, and I had to fend for my business because I employed almost 60, 70 people. I had a young family at that time. Both the girls were in just school. And but because having a strong family with my wife always on my side, with extraordinarily great friends, and a tremendous faith I had in myself, because I never ever allowed to lose faith in my own self. I knew that I would make it. None of those mistakes, none of those debacles were blunders on my side. They were definitely issue of misjudgment. Ultimately, in 2008, I started looking to rebuild on what I have lost, and started scaling down my business ventures, looking to find the right thing. Then I came across the partners and then shareholders of EFS who were looking for a business entrepreneur. And they wanted somebody who has taken risk in life and knows how to manage it, has a deep inside of the local industry. Facility management was not my domain then, but they realized that I, as a businessman, understands. And being a businessman from SME background, you definitely have a strong sense of bill of quantities. And you understand what is the intrinsic cost of doing things.
Yeah. So what made you then basically decide from going to, from like actually founding a company and being the entrepreneur to starting as like a corporate CEO?
What basically helped me, I realized that since my core strength lies in cross-border, my core strength lies in strategic, my thinking has always been very, very, my vision has always been very, very wide and big. And realizing that for something like this, if I have to continue keep looking to find a totally independent, an autonomous institution of that I would run and lead and own is not easy. I needed capital. And I realized one thing, if I find the right capital platform, which has got adequate capital, I can do much more better on the scalability front. And that's exactly what I did. So with EFS, the mistakes that I did with the past two ventures were 100% own entities of my own that I was driving. And as and when things go, when you go through a difficult period or you have difficult market conditions, to sustain on your own is not easy, because you don't have a godfather, neither you have a strong capital base. Yeah. And any significant market changes can impact your long-term plans. So the many things that I learned from my previous experiences and that I applied in EFS, I never gave up my long-term vision. So first thing what I did when I took over EFS is...
So how big was the company when you joined it?
Not even 100 million. It was 60, 70 million, $20 million company then.
So 60 million in annual revenue.
That's right, correct. And they were, at that time, it was operating in five countries, but all the companies were loss-making. They had some good contracts, but most of the contracts were losing. Either clients were very unhappy, the employees were not paid in time, and there were indeed challenges. I did see an opportunity in the platform. I did see an opportunity in the market. The first thing I did was to put together a team of competent people. I was able to put some short... I definitely realized if I need to hold on and grow from here, I need to first have some short wins, short and medium wins, and then look for a long-term win. So between the short and medium, I worked around reducing the overheads, brought in new service lines in order to help to improve the net profits, and then build on partnership with banks and with shareholders to give them sufficient confidence so that if they cannot support on equity, but they could support on banking, bank guarantees and others. So I think the first thing I did was able to get the confidence of the shareholders to support in my... And I was given really for all throughout between then and now, my shareholders have always been a part of the biggest support in building this organization. Well, indeed, there's so many... The list is endless when you look at about who do I want to give this, who do I dedicate the success to. I think there's so many people in it, but shareholders, employees, those who have been with me for the last 10 years, my core C-suite who have been through the thick and thin of this journey. And I think from a 20 million to a billion enterprise, in just 10 years, it cannot be an individual. It's not just about an individual, whether you call him a CEO or the co-founder or whatever it is. It is the entire team of people that have backed and supported that.
So you came in like company was worth $20 million, now it's worth $1 billion. Yeah. What else changed?
It was from $20 million to it is $400 million. When we talk about billion, I'm talking billion in dirhams, and I'm talking about 60 million in dirhams. Then, so it's three times. It. That's right. So that is what I've done. I'm holding at this moment a value of business of more than 5.2 billion. In dirhams, which is almost $1.7 billion. So that's the unbilled contracts that I have to. So I continue keep. In our business, we have more than 200 clients of ours are amongst the most. 99% of our clients are billion-dollar organizations, of which more than 200 are the global majors. 200 clients, you name it, any one of them, whether it's Apple, whether it's Oracle, if it is Microsoft, or if it is
so what, what's IBM the average contract size,
ENG or anyone. Our contract sizes depends. We have got contracts of $100 million as well, and we have got a contract of I would say my smallest contract would nothing be less than a half a million dirham minimum.
Got it. Explain a little bit. What do you do for those companies?
What we've been doing for? See, anything, we are primarily a maintenance and housekeeping and a security company. So what we do is a facility management services company. Anything outside your non-core services, we manage everything. In certain institutions, we do more than 100 services. In certain, we just do few select services. So the scope of our services varies from housekeeping, security, building maintenance, to reception services, to mailroom services, to providing office assistants, to receptionist services, fuel services, transportation services, food services. So you name it, anything under the integrated facility management services, we've been delivering those services across 21 countries in 3 subcontinents. We also manage some of the larger infrastructure projects. We also manage some master communities. So if you look at it, we manage almost 44 million square meters of real estate across from Bangladesh all the way up to Nigeria, from north, from Turkey to all the way to south to Pakistan. And we operate in every country in GCC, Levant, and now we are moving shortly to Israel as well. So that's what our business is all about.
So where do you want to take the company in the next 10 years, maybe? I don't know how long you're planning to stay there.
I don't think I would ever want to retire, because that's not something that exists in my life. Being a person which can, I'm of the opinion, if you can add value by virtue of your experience, your far sights, your insights that you have gained over the years, you should always look forward to be a performing asset and sharing that experiences. In context to EFS, I definitely don't see anything less than 10 years. I don't see a challenge for myself in the next 10 years. So I'm going to be stuck up in this role as a CEO for a fairly long period of time. Now, where I want to take the company from here? Indeed, there are many plans. The plan is our next 10-year plan of the organization is definitely $3 billion in revenues. We would like to be the leaders. We would like to remain a formidable player within core facility management. However, we will add on many more shared services as a way to build the organization to the next level. Because facility management has its limitation in terms of, whilst there is growth in this industry, but it has also a limitation of how much you can add on in your revenues should you look at traditional FM services. So EFS has got plans to have a quantum jump in its revenue by bringing in some additional services such as long-term concession agreements that we intend to get involved with, expanding our shared services such as payroll and various other, so that we could actually take on all non-core services from large clients. And third business is the staffing and manpower solutions that we would like to expand on. So within these three, a combination of organic growth. Organic will still be our main driver of our growth. Since we have been on a compounded annual growth, our historical has been over 20%. So we assume that we will still be maintaining the same over the next 10 years. And the rest will come through acquisition of some of the flagship contracts as well as acquisitions.
Got it. Interesting plans. Excited to follow you along the way in the next few years. What are three principles that you apply to EFS as a company, like core business principles that are important to you And I don't mean like, for example, core values within the company or things like that, but like actual business principles.
Well, I think I would say value embodiment has always been very critical to my business. So I went on to build value embodiment across every single aspect of my business, both in terms of, for example, my partnership with my clients is based on very transparent, very one-to-one relationship where we have driven operational excellence and commercial prudence and sustainability as the core principle of our organization. Now, within these three, between the when we talk about operational excellence, then we've taken into account that our fundamental business is providing services to clients. And if we don't emphasize on operational excellence, we cannot move on to the next level of value proposition for which we've been hired. The second aspect was the commercial prudence. By when people engage ourselves, they also expect us that as a facility manager, as a facility manager, we should be able to emphasize on the value addition of what value engineering we do in terms of cost for them. Sustainability has always been part of my principle in life in every sense. So if I talk about what has been my three core principles, operational excellence, commercial prudence, and sustainability.
Got it. Yeah, thanks for your view on those principles. A question that I always like to ask is, what do you think is your core skill as a CEO?
My foresight in context to, I'm able to I can see things through and understand and zero in on the likely outcomes. So my foresight and my judgment of people and situation due to my previous experiences makes me a very realistic business strategist.
Got it. You also in our personal meetings in Dubai, you talked a lot about thought leadership. What does thought leadership mean to you, and why do you think it's important?
See, thought leadership is you have over the last 30 years or over the last, I'm 55, during the journey in life, learned so many different aspects. Having been through a very diverse background, lived in small villages, helped to, you know, to work with family and friends on plugging fields and then, you know, driving and now one of the finest cars, and then in the initial years, you know, sitting on those bullock carts. So my diversity, both in terms of my cultural diversity, my belief in diversity in terms of religious beliefs, I have always believed humanity as a core value. Never, no ever religion has ever influenced me. So, and my real life journey of through so many, you know, where I could say that I was able to demonstrate at every stage a very outstanding example of what I have said and what I believed in it. And I think this is where today I believe when I talk about thought leadership, I share those experiences. My ability because of my financial services background, my deep insight into numbers, and I always maintain that numbers speak, but it is up to the analyst to how to make numbers speak. My deep understanding of the region, my core understanding of the bill of quantities, intrinsic cost analysis. I can build a house and I can prepare a budget for the house from a domestic housewife budget to a building, or when we bid for $1 billion contracts, I can, within a very short period of time, I can zero in on very, very, you know, extraordinarily good hold on numbers and ability to forecast budget trends and others. So these are the things that I believe has helped me to write about it. I'm very passionate about exchanging my experiences. I refer to everything that I write is based on my own experience. I never cut and paste from anywhere. I never take quotable quotes from others. Whilst there are many people in life have influenced me, but my biggest influence is my own experiences in life.
Yeah, got it.
You might be aware of that. I have also had a health exigency back in 2013, where I was diagnosed with a thyroid cancer. And initially, the take from the doctor was that it could be a stage 4. But the journey has been one of the most amazing journeys of my life. For those 20 days when I went through, between the time I diagnosed it by the time I was operated and till the time I was given the final conclusion that it was just a yes, indeed it was malignant, it was removed, and there was no threat from there on, because after the frozen therapy they realized that it did not spread anywhere. And this is my sixth year living after that initial scare. And my life has been extraordinarily enriching and experienced from that experience.
Yeah, I know. We talked about that. Thanks for your view on that. Okay, Tarek, let's wrap up here with the Fantastic Four. Question number one, is there a CEO that you're following or studying right now?
Well, I think if I have to look at a CEO, that has really influenced me, and he's no more a CEO, but I'm definitely more, is somebody like Bill Gates. He's been my, I still believe he was one CEO that I followed, and I'm extraordinarily amazed and impressed with him. And if I have to go my way of life, I would follow the Bill Gates way.
Got it. Thank you. Do you have any routines that you strictly follow on a day-to-day basis?
Routines have been part of one of the biggest strengths of mine is my routines. I'm very disciplined. So I wake up in the morning at 5:30. I do my yoga and then I do my short prayer. And then I'm at work by 7:30. My morning routine also starts with having a tea with my wife and my daughter. Writing a small note. Most of my writing happens in the morning. So between 5:30 till 7:30, and between these 2 hours, my routine includes a small writing, a newspaper, and a tea that is close to my heart, a morning tea, and a chat with my daughter and my wife. And then followed by yoga. And then I start my day with the office. And I don't look back. For me, meetings are there for resolution. I have usually least discussion, more emphasis on resolution or action plan or a way towards the resolution. So I always look for outcomes and milestones. And every meeting has a follow-up discussion and a defined milestone.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really good. What's your favorite social media platform for business, and what do you use it for?
Well, LinkedIn has been, I am been a user of LinkedIn since 2001. One of the very, very early stages I've started LinkedIn. So LinkedIn has always been my favorite. Initially, it was more of, getting connect to people. But over the years, it has now become a platform for business connectivity. It's also becoming a platform to some great insights that you get from people in terms of presentations and others. And I don't think beyond this, I am not doing anything on any other social media. I am of the opinion that I have a certain target group that I want to connect with, or who I would like to connect with, or I would want some people to connect with me. And I believe LinkedIn offers me a holistic solution in that.
Got it. Okay, last question, Tariq. What do you wish you knew when you were 20 years old?
When I was 20 years old, I wanted to be a CEO at 30. I have accomplished everything that I wanted from a child. As a child, I was, as I mentioned to you, I was always very ambitious. So I had plans on every aspect of luxury has been a part of my, it was never a milestone for me, a luxury. It was something in me. As and when I could afford, I started on it. And today, in the last, between the time I've started earning and now, I am amongst the top 50 passengers of the Emirates Airline. I am one of the top client of these Four Seasons. I do have an opportunity of driving some great cars. I do live in a reasonably decent house. So luxury is not a milestone or a benchmark for me. It is more of something where I feel for me to accomplish things, I should have that. So when I was young, I always had these things, but it was never the milestones of my life. I thought that I should have this. CEO, I knew very clearly at the age of 30 that I wanted to be a CEO, and I did become a CEO when I was 29. I'm stuck up in this role for a fairly long period of time. But for me, a CEO was never an I title that I was looking at that stage also. I always wanted that I should be, my role should be meaningful. I should be able to impact with that role, the community at large, people in general who have expectations from me, my family, my extended family. I always wanted to be a role model for both my daughters. I wanted to be a husband who's adored and loved by my wife. So I think in context to all those benchmarks that I had when I was 20, I think I'm very, very privileged that I have almost got everything that I wanted. Now, over the years, I have built on some extended list of things that I want to do. And I want to remain in public life. I want to make a difference to people's life. Wealth is never neither a milestone for me or neither a part of my goal. Yeah. I see it. It will come in the journey. What I want to accomplish, and I don't have none of my things that I want to accomplish has anything to do with wealth in it. I assume whatever little bit I need it will come across during because I can create definitive value for everyone. And if I have a genuine and legitimate earning from the role or from the outcomes that I deliver for my stakeholders, that's what I look at it.
Got it. Yeah, no, these are great points. Thank you so much for your insights, Tariq.
Thank you, please.